You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Very good evening, and thank you all very much for coming to this, what promises to be a very, very interesting and stimulating discussion about a very topical issue, the new media, the digital media. My name is Behruz Afa. I work for the BBC World Service. I'm responsible for journalism in the World Service for Middle East and Asia. I'm the moderator. I'm your moderator this evening. And before I introduce the discussion, let me warn you that this whole event is being recorded as live on television, and it's going to be archived on the web, and it's going to be streamed on at least three websites, the addresses of which are here. I can pass it on later if you want to watch yourselves. So be careful what you say. Just a warning. So what we are talking about tonight, I think probably it's fair to say that it's a cliche to talk about information and media revolution in the last 10 years, but it is true. It is a cliche because it's so true that the digital revolution in the last decade or so has brought a massive, massive change to the way we consume information, to the way we travel, to the way we do shopping, and to the way we do politics. And also, it's become a very hot talking point. You would find very many people, ordinary people, talk a lot about how new media is changing politics and changing our lives. One piece of very interesting statistics that I saw recently is that there are more people using a mobile phone now than they use toothpastes. So, you know, or a toothbrush. More people use the mobile phone than they use a toothbrush. They brush their teeth. So it's a massive phenomenon. So, how our lives have changed by the new digital media, by the new digital revolution, is a very, very important topic. One of the most comprehensive, perhaps, studies of how digital media is changing the way we consume information is the project that OSF has supported through the media and information programs, and it's called Mapping the Digital Media. It's been going on for the last 2-3 years, and it is producing a very, very comprehensive report about how media trends are developing and changing in large parts of the world. It covers a very, very wide geography. The person who's managing this project is Marius Dragomir, who I would introduce as our first speaker. He's going to give you a brief overview of what this research is doing, and then we'll come back to a number of our panelists who have helped produce that report, and we'll get some comments from them before we come to questions and answers.
Marius. Thank you, Behruz. Before I get into that, for those who want to tweet this event, please use the hashtag MDM. Mapping digital media. Well, it is, I believe, the largest research undertaking that the media and the information programs at the Open Society Foundations have ever taken. It's a project covering indeed a large geographical area. We are examining digital media in 60 countries on all continents. And so far, indeed, we have been working for almost 3 years on this project. So far, we have in various stages of editing almost half of these reports, to be more precise, 27 reports. 8 of these reports have been already published, and you can consult them on the websites that I believe are listed on your little paper that you found on your chairs. Why? I would try to answer the question, why are we doing that? Well, we are doing that because digital media are changing indeed massively the ways we consume and access news content. Secondly, I think digital media are producing many changes to the role and position and influence of public service media in society. Thirdly, digital media are affecting, sometimes in a positive manner, sometimes in a negative manner, affecting, as I said, the ways people are reacting to media coverage. And equally, digital media are affecting the ways journalists are researching their stories and writing their articles. And equally, digital media are affecting the size, the speed, and the forms of cash flow in today's media markets, and the ways media are regulated and legislated. In other words, all these changes are affecting the ways we are getting ourselves informed. So this is Mapping Digital Media, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from our guests about what's happening in the countries they are either covering as editors or authors of the national reports.
Thank you very much. There will be a chance later on, if you've got questions, to ask that Marius and other colleagues who've worked very closely in this project to answer, or indeed people on this panel. I think one of the most important features, aspects of this work is that a lot of people, dozens of people, are involved in drawing up, researching and drawing up the reports from various countries. And we've got three people who've been very closely involved in that. And we're going to hear very briefly again a comment from each of them about something that they, the trends that they find interesting or emerging from their part of the world. And then we'll open up for discussion and questions. So the people, the panel, the people on the panel, from my left is Fernando Bermejo, who is Associate Professor of Communications at University of Rey Juan Carlos in Spain. And he is the editor of the report on Latin American world. We have got Aboubakr Jemaei, who's the editor of the Arab World Report. And Aboubakr is also the editor of lacombe.com, which is a very highly successful news site in Morocco. And we've got Tom Glazier, who is a fellow of Knight Media Policy and works for New America Foundation, and is one of the authors of the American Report. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to speak for 2-3 minutes, as it were, piece to camera, and then we'll ask questions. And I'm going to start with Aboubakr, because kind of in a way he represents the most topical countries, the Arab world, and we've heard so much about the impact of media on the revolution that we've seen there. So Aboubakr, I mean, if I wanted to ask a question, I guess you started the work on this project well before these revolutions. Do you have to update it now? Or?
Well, take a wild guess. Of course, if you talk to our researchers who are working on these countries, they have headaches, actually, because they started out this journey on with MDM in a different universe. They're a new world right now, and they have to adjust to what's going on. Just to give you one small example, Morocco, which is supposed not to have known a revolution. When the researchers began to work, there were 800,000 Facebook users. At the end of their research, there were 3 million. So this is the type of massive change that is just not a statistic. It's more than that. It is illustrative to a profound change in society. And actually, a lot of academics are right now trying to make sense of the relationship between social media and revolutions. We've heard a lot of journalistic stories about social media in the Arab world. We are yet to see some solid academic piece on how exactly social media had played a role into motivating, igniting, organizing these revolutions. There is, I think, one piece of research from the University of Washington which showed that there was a linkage between social media and the activities on social media and revolutions. But the account on as to how it exactly played out is not clear yet. And I believe a lot of political scientists and media experts will work on these issues for a very long time. But I don't think there is a doubt that social media and internet has empowered people to move. You know, one of the one of the big solid findings in political science is that you cannot predict a revolution. And one of the explanation is because that type of information in authoritarian societies is kept secret, is private. We call it private. So you cannot fathom what people are thinking. So you can surmise what they might do, revolt or not. So maybe, and this is a very personal adventurous conjecture, maybe that social media had played a role of allowing people to know a little bit of what was going on in their neighborhood, that maybe their neighbor is thinking likewise, that they really don't like Ben Ali, they really don't like Mubarak. And secondly, that we know a little bit more about, it played a role into organizing people. There was, for example, in this study from the University of Washington, we see a spike in tweets about, you know, what will happen in Tahrir Square, then it happens in Tahrir Square. So obviously there is communication going on there. So to sum what I have to say is actually we are at the very early stages of how exactly internet, social media had played a role into this revolution.
I mean, one big question is that what's your sense? Is this just an urban thing? But many people may argue that yes, I can see this playing a very big role in Cairo, for instance, among the young university students. But somehow an Egyptian farmer, how is social media kind of reaching him, or directly or indirectly?
I think it's safe to say that it is an urban thing. It is definitely an urban thing, but the revolution, when they happened outside the big cities, happened in small cities, but yet cities, small urban centers. So I think that urbanization is part of the story somehow in what happened in the Arab world, and the rate of urbanization is certainly in the mix. It is certainly out there in this equation that might explain what happened recently in the Arab world.
Okay, we'll come back to this question, I'm sure. Okay, let's move on to Tom Glazier, who's one of the authors of the American report. What are the kinds of conclusions you are beginning to draw from your work?
Well, thankfully, we haven't faced quite the upheaval that Abu Bakr has. There's still something different going on. There is still a significant change. The barriers to entry, the ability to produce content is open to many, if not everyone, who has a connection and who can afford a connection, who has the skills of a broadband connection. There's something magical about this openness of the internet. The flip side is that the media economic, the flows of money around media companies, despite us often spending more money on media and communications and spending more time looking at news, those of us who look at news, there's less money going to journalism. There's less money going to produce facts that will hold the powerful to account. And it's this paradox of more content and less, fewer journalists. By some estimates, somewhere between $800 million and $1.3 billion a year in annual editorial salaries have been lost over the last few years. And that's a huge sum. And much as I may admire my own tweets, T. Glazier, you've got to really draw, it's difficult to, you know, I don't try and compare my tweets to Jill Abramson's tweets or other senior journalists who really have worked in the trenches and are day-to-day reporting on news. And I think we have to really take a hard look at what's happened. It hasn't happened in a vacuum. There are policies in the US that have created some wonderful things, but have also created significant challenges for us as a democracy with the media we've got now. And I'll just leave it at that for now. There's plenty more to be said.
I think coming to the question of policy, I think I can imagine in a country which has got an authoritarian regime trying to filter the internet, etc. So policy does matter. In a way, I mean, naive question is that in a country like America, you know, free information, people can produce whatever they like, people can read whatever they like. What's the need for policy? What's the need for media policy?
That's a great question. It seems, well, isn't this great? Can we just go home? But it hasn't happened for no reason. There are ownership limits on the number of radio or TV stations someone can own in a market or own around across the country. Spectrum, key for distributing an increasingly mobile environment, is allocated on a basis, and it's been allocated on different bases over time. Its allocation of the allocation of the spectrum by the FCC to non-commercial radio and television stations in the 50s and 60s created a set of institutions that have really served us quite well in many ways. Now, maybe they should be doing more, but there's something quite special about the way spectrum is allocated, ownership is limited or constrained, that produces a certain media system that will serve us for better or for worse.
Okay, thanks very much. Let's move on to Fernando, perspective from Latin American world.
First of all, I guess if you want to make a summary of what the situation of digital media in a region like Latin America is, I think at first you need to take a couple of steps back. One is the one that I had to do when I started working in this project, which is what will we mean by digitization and digital media. And I realized that even though we all seem to understand what it is, when we actually have to be precise about it, it's much more complicated than it seems. And I realized that actually when we talk about digital media, we're talking about many different things. Yeah, digitization is a very kind of, technical term that can be applied in many fields. And so when we're talking about it, we're talking on the one hand about how mass media are moving into the digital realm, and talking about television, talking about radio, I'm talking about the print press. And then on the other hand, you can think of digital media as basically what goes on the internet, which is digital, it's kind of native digital. And so those two waves seem to be colliding. And I think what we're witnessing right now is that moment of flux in which those two things are happening at the same time. And we're seeing a new space for communication and media evolving and being born. On the other hand, there is also an issue of regional trends. Latin America is a pretty big area, geographic area. And so there are many differences between, let's say, countries in Central America like Nicaragua or Guatemala and what goes on in Brazil or Argentina or Colombia. So there are many different details that get lost when we just do a general summary. So having said that, what I perceive as emerging is, on the one hand, the media, the traditional media, are slowly moving into the digital realm. There is a process of transition from analog to digital television happening in almost every country, but it's still going to take about a decade for that process to finish. And so there's still the first few steps, so it's difficult to tell how that's going to play out. In terms of the internet, on the other hand, you can see a growing numbers of users and penetration of the internet in basically all these countries. Very different as well, that some countries have very high internet penetration, some others are still pretty low. But the use of, for instance, social networks is huge among the people who are connected, which of course then there we have to look at differences in terms of digital divides and rural versus urban areas and educated versus uneducated people. But I would say that in these two ways that I was describing at the beginning, probably the one that comes from the internet it's coming with more force than the one that is moving from analog mass media into digital mass media. Mm-hmm.
How about as a kind of social revolution or accountability phenomena in countries which are less democratic than others? Is it seen, like for instance, increasingly in the Arab world or countries where there is a struggle for democracy? Is it seen, the social media and the internet, as a tool which can be used for that?
You can see that it's being used. However, it's still In terms of activism, it's still a very small number of people who are doing that, and the repercussions are not as broadly felt as some might wish or think it does.
Good. Thanks very much. Okay, let's open up to questions and comments and kind of particularly if you've got direct experience of media in any of the countries that we've discussed, or indeed countries that we haven't discussed, a comment or insight that you've got to share. It'll be very, very useful. And can I ask you, please, also, when you want to speak, say who you are and what organization you represent. Microphone there.
Hello, Daud Kutta from Community Media Network in Amman, Jordan, covering some Middle East countries. The question to Abu Bakr, but also to the other panelists. The fact of the government control of most of the media in the Arab countries, radio and television almost 100% controlled by government, most of the newspapers are partially or fully controlled by governments. Did that trigger, because of the availability of social media, because of the globalization, basically invited many countries, wanted to be involved in globalization for exchanging goods, and as a result, they also were forced to exchange information. So was there a relationship between the fact that media was very repressive in the sense of ownership and platforms, and at the same time, some of the same countries were basically encouraging globalization for economic reasons, and they got stuck also with the information globalization that basically brought them down. So can you talk about that relationship between media repression, globalization, and the information exchange?
It's clearly one of the contradictions of pro-market authoritarian systems, where you adhere, and it's part of your marketing campaign toward the West that you adhere to pro-market policies, but at the same time, you are using authoritarian policies toward your own people. I think one of the interesting cases to illustrate this point is what happened in Egypt, when at some point, I think Mubarak shut down internet completely. But the same gesture, he killed off a whole industry of, I don't remember the name, the call centers industry, because they were using internet. So by trying to quell the revolution, he was wiping out a whole industry, which was very important for Egypt. So definitely, yes, here you just put your finger on this very, very central contradiction in how they did, and how globalization is not only a dirty word. I mean, it can be something positive, and in this very case, it certainly played a role. And it's a reputational thing as well. For Morocco, for example, one of the good things, one of the positive aspects of Morocco vis-a-vis media and internet is that internet has been free almost 100%, with here and there some censorship towards Islamist websites, pro-Sahrawi websites, etc. But by and large, compared to the rest of the Arab world, it has been free. And one of the major reasons, it's not that the regime is philosophically, completely in liking this freedom of speech, etc., but because it's part of how Morocco has to be perceived in general, and it led to the creation of a public space that has been used and is being used by the pro-democracy activists. So on another scale, you can version that. Tunisia, it's interesting to see how the Ben Ali's regime was so adamant in organizing the ITU summit, the telecommunications summit, a few years ago, with the huge row that happened. Well, you can look at it from the angle of the regime. For the regime to be so put so much energy into being perceived as being pro freedom of speech and free and technologically advanced by hosting this summit, in itself shows this contradiction in their behavior.
My name is Colin Sam from Nigeria, currently visiting scholar at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights, Columbia University. My question is about looking at what the moderators thought about the urban phenomena. You know, I'm a little bit curious about the role of media, especially in the Arab Revolution. If you consider it as an urban phenomena, will it be that the media played a role in more like encouraging the revolution, why it might not have been the majority of the people, if you consider that the people in the rural area had no access to media and were not part of it, will it not be fair to say that the media more like encouraged the revolution without actually, you know, being a true representative of various country? And then my second comment is that being from Nigeria and sub-Saharan Africa, I could have been more interested in seeing maybe a report on the media in sub-Saharan Africa. Thank you.
Okay. What's your own experience of changes in the media in Africa? And particularly, I mean, not necessarily media in the very traditional sense, but this advent of, for instance, the importance of mobile phones, for instance.
Definitely, in Nigeria, there's been a tremendous growth in the role of mobile phone and the media. But again, it's more an elitist thing. So, you know, if you consider it as an elitist thing, maybe because I'm an activist, if you consider it as an elitist thing, so you cannot say precisely that it reflects the majority thought. You know, I go to the villages, I work in the communities. Majority of those in the community have a cell phone just to communicate. They don't use the Facebook, they don't use Twitter, they don't use all those fancy stuff. So it's only the elite and the educated that use those things to communicate. And that can actually be a tool for manipulation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Comment at the back then.
Ann Nelson, I teach at Columbia School of International Public Affairs, and I have a few of my students here, I'm glad to say. Tom Glaser, you and I have been corresponding recently about some movement in the spectrum assignment, or at least the proposals to allocate more of the spectrum to first responders and to help public service organizations in general have more access. It seems to be a fairly technical area, and I was wondering if you could update us and tell us what's happening with that discussion.
It is an incredibly technical area. So I'll just sort of unpack it a little and give a general update. There is, as we know in the US, some questions around the federal deficit. One of the solutions to solving that is to sell spectrum for the highest value, to basically repurpose spectrum and allocate unallocated spectrum to different purposes. So there are currently a number of different ways this can happen. You can encourage the broadcasters to give up some spectrum, perhaps for if you sell it for a dollar, they get 20 cents, and they give it up for 20 cents, and the Treasury gets 80. You can take currently unallocated spectrum and sell it in the same way, and the Treasury gets $100 for every dollar it's sold for. Or you take unallocated spectrum and allocate it for different uses. And there are several proposals for those different uses. One, driven quite strongly by the public safety lobby for the allocation of unallocated spectrum, and some energized by the anniversary of 9/11, that really we need to get on this because we don't want to solve this problem of first responders being able to speak to each other. And the other is allocating that spectrum to unlicensed uses. And that would be a sort of Wi-Fi on steroids. So we think of Wi-Fi at home that goes through one wall or two. And it's kind of useful. And we've all really, many of us have deployed it in our houses. Well, imagine if you could take a much better band of radio spectrum that actually goes not yards but miles. And imagine if that was allocated on a opportunistic or unlicensed basis, that everyone got there, they could use it when they needed it. We designed devices that used it, how much innovation that could yield. And really what's going on in Congress is a battle between the forces who want as much money for the Treasury as possible, bar nothing, a group who wants some spectrum allocated for public safety, dedicated public safety, and then a group who are supportive of unlicensed spectrum. I personally am very interested in the unlicensed opportunity because I think it will spur incredible innovation and connectivity and lower our costs for connectivity. But I'm really hoping for some sort of balanced outcome. As with many things in Congress these days, I'm not optimistic.
I wanted to ask you a question. Do you have any work inside of Cuba? And if you do, I would like to know what the young people in Cuba have access to.
Unfortunately, that's Cuba is not one of the countries that it's being covered in the Latin American region. We have Mexico, which is a report that it's already finished and published, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Colombia, Peru, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil, and Uruguay, but not in Cuba, unfortunately. So, I mean, I couldn't speak beyond what I know from reading the news about what goes on in Cuba, about what really is happening there in terms of access to media or the internet. I wouldn't be able to specify any information that you probably don't have already. So.
True tradition of new media. Is there anyone in the audience who knows more about it? About Cuba, what's going on there? Okay. Yeah, do you have any more information about Cuba? Would you mind kind of telling us what you...
What you have is this incredible hacker culture going on in Cuba. Hugo Chavez just has been building a fiber optic cable to Cuba, which is going to be multiplying the bandwidth many times over. And so everybody's saying, how do political leaders who incline towards censorship think they're going to control this expansion of content? Because they're not like the Chinese, where they have tens of thousands of censors sitting ready to go after it. So you're going to have this explosion of access. You've got telecentros, which have been designed in Brazil, but are being built out rapidly in Venezuela and now in Cuba, that give community access. So school children get them during the day. Community people get access to the internet after school hours. There's government vigilance. There's a very lively blogging culture. Yoani Sanchez has become an international rock star. And she builds her computers pretty much out of parts that have been thrown in the garbage, partly because of our embargo, which means that we can't get advanced equipment to the people who are pressing for democracy in Cuba. So there we are, back to policy.
Thank you very much. Thanks. The lady here, the gentleman at the back there.
My name is Atili. I'm also from Colombia, Columbia University. My question to Sir Abu, you said about from 800,000 to 3 million, right, Facebook. Like, we're talking about how the new media has influenced or positively. Are there also, out of the 3 million, were there a few thousands who were pro-government, you know? Because I'm a journalist, but I also know that in India, I come from Northeast, I'm from Nagaland, hundreds of fake identities in the name of counterinsurgency, they suppress movements, they influence the youth, you know? So it's like, I just wanted from the...
Okay, Arab let's get, a, thank you very much. Let's get one or two more questions in and then we'll try and answer them. The lady in the front there.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm Lydia, I'm from Uganda. I work with the Women Integrated Initiative for Development, but I'm here as a visiting scholar at Columbia University. My question is, it's going to be like an observation, but also a question is, how will you be able to verify that the same people who are maybe signing up for Twitter, Facebook, and the same people who are using the TVs and televisions are different people? Because it could be the same people, but they are just skipping to change. And then the other one is, what is your finding on the role of women in influencing digital revolution or in the use or access? I don't know, something like that.
Okay, one more question at the back there, the lady there, yep.
Thank you very much. I'm Elvis Mbembe. I'm from Rwanda. And I'm one of the 14 advocates participating to the Human Rights Advocate Program at Columbia University. I've noticed that media is really a powerful instrument. This cannot be proved today because we know what happened in the Arab world. But this is a positive change. but it can also contribute in a negative change. Those who followed the 1994 genocide in Rwanda remember what was the role of the sadly famous Radio Télé de Mille Collines. At that time, they tried to find ways to interfere with their broadcast. At that time, I think also it could be done because only we did not yet have digitalized media as today. But today, with the proliferation of digital media, such as internet, mobile phones, iPad, and so on, I'm wondering how we can still control such issues, media, especially when it's going at the bad side.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's try and, do you want to first talk about how were we sure that, let's say that the 800, the new people who are using the social network in Morocco are not necessarily, the question was that were they also, did they also include government supporters, mm-hmm. for instance, or were they all kind of opposition?
You have two type of government supporters. You have those who are paid to be government supporters and those who are ideologically convinced by the government or the regime position, that's a better word. And the problem is with the first kind, not the second one. The second one is absolutely, their presence is absolutely legitimate in the agora, in the public space. We think that in Morocco we had some people who were employed by the government to be present on the internet, on Facebook, on Twitter, and to hound people who were advocating democratization in the country. Now, from my personal experience, if they were paid to do it, the few I thought were paid to do it were not very astute, because it suffices to look at their profile on Facebook, which is very easy to do. For example, you find there was one who was a Harvard graduate with four friends. You know, for example, that was very, very unlikely. A Moroccan Harvard graduate with four friends, that was not very plausible. So that kind of things. But at the end of the day, the conversation that took place ended up being a constructive one, in the sense that it was not polluted enough to become meaningless. And that's a very positive outcome, I believe, of this explosion of internet usage and social media usage in particular. I know that in Tunisia, during the Ben Ali's phase, that obviously this is a story that has been well reported on. Social media have been used, the internet, as the traditional media has been completely domesticated. The government has put a lot of resources into trying to control social media as well by paying people to go on the internet and go after democratic activists. This is to say that this is a double-edged sword, that this is a medium, which means that it can be used by the government. The other thing about internet is everything is traceable. Technically speaking, so if you are as a state rich enough, and generally you're richer than your opponents, you can always hire some Western company that will give you the technological tools to trace back whatever is going on your blogosphere, on your Twittersphere, on your Facebook. So this is a real challenge. So it is a double-edged sword, and it seems that the democracy activists are a little bit ahead of the curve on this one. Besides, again, you know, we shouldn't think, you know, the way I'm talking about this might lead us to think that social media were a center stage into the revolution. I don't, again, let me just repeat that. We did not sort out the real weight of each phenomena, urbanization, social media, demographic bulge. All of these things are still being worked out in the mix that led to the revolution, and it's premature to say that social media were central. They played a role. We don't know yet what type of role and to what extent they have contributed to the revolution.
Okay, the other three kind of points were fairly general. Can it be a force for evil as well? Can it help the forces of evil, which I guess Abu Bakr replied to some extent, but we'll go back to the others as well. But also the involvement of women, and then also how can we differentiate between users of different medium? Who wants to go have a go at it?
Well, in terms of the evil uses of the media, I guess as every human tool can be used for many different purposes, what you would hope is that by promoting access and diversity in the production and distribution of media, those evil uses will be countered by other more positive ones. So I guess that's my best answer at that. In terms of the issue of how do you know who's using what and where, that would lead us in a very kind of tangent direction, which is also relevant, which is the issue of how do you know what goes on online and what are the tools that we have to know what goes on online and who has access to that information. And that's a very complicated situation because we tend to do comparisons between media and say, for instance, 40% of newspaper readers read the New York Times, but 80% of online users use Google, so the internet is actually more concentrated than the print press. Actually, beyond or below the level of Google go on so many things that are so different from what goes on behind or below the name of a newspaper. It's so much more complex what is behind a URL than what is behind a newspaper name. It's difficult to make those kinds of comparisons. And so if you want to go specifically what goes on within a particular website, then we have the issue of access to data. The data is precious, as we all know. It's a wonderful commodity. That's what drives the online economy. And so you're not going to be able to get the data from the companies that own that data. And there are all these different platforms, so to speak, that own a lot of data about online behavior. None of them, of course, want to share that data with other platforms and let alone with researchers because that's their goal. That's how they make money.
Okay. And any kind of insights about the... I'll
respond a little bit.
Women as well.
Yeah, I'll try and respond to as many points as I can. I start off with the internet is liberty and openness, and there's a paradox of the potential for control and what Facebook can, if the Stasi still existed now, Facebook would tell them all that they ever dreamed of. And you get to some really serious questions of how can you get out of that issue? Because can you regulate your way out of the issue? Or is ultimately, if that data exists, someone's always going to be able to get hold of it? So then you start getting into questions of design and questions of not storing things in centralized databases or storing them in a distributed manner, encrypted on your own data stick. And these are the sort of questions we're going to have to struggle with. And I'll respond to the gentleman from Rwanda. I got into this business in a way by looking at the genocide in Rwanda and media, and always reflect on that. The community media here is a soft, fluffy word in the US. It's a nice thing. We all want more of it. And the low-power radio stations that earlier this year, there was an act called the Local Community Radio Act, which was signed by President Obama, which is going to open up more community radio stations. It's going to be a very good thing, a very positive, because of the ecosystem in which those stations exist in. For Rwanda, it was not. They were tools of the genocidaires and terribly problematic. And we really need to retool our policymaking apparatus for this converged world of digital data and consider what we do. And just to reiterate a little bit on the questions of anonymity and verification, the online economy, as Fernando mentioned, depends on that. Yet, the questions of justice in a world with total surveillance, I think, just are sitting out there, and how we address them, both in policy and design, are yet to be resolved.
Okay. Any insights, any kind of interesting trends about involvement of women? I don't know, Marius, as somebody who's, you know, okay, nothing, any, no particular comment on that?
The one thing I have heard about in the UK, and this may be incorrect, the use of the sort of moms network in the Millie Dowler response to the hacking furore, that I think the shadow of that latent group of connected people was, you know, known and recognized by politicians.
I think that's a good sort of hint or segue for a video that we've got about the hacking saga and how, if you like, the over-concentration of media control can damage, and you know what effect it can have on relationship between media and politics. I think we've got two video comments, very brief, 2 minutes each. One from UK by Des Friedman, who's the author of the UK report, and he's particularly commenting about the News International scandal. I think we'll play the video in a minute, and we'll come back to the question.
I think the phone hacking saga brought to the attention of millions and millions of people in the UK what the impact can be of concentrated media power, that an organisation like News Corporation can have its fingers in so many puddings, have so much influence, be able to draw on friends in the police and in government in a very unhealthy way for democracy. Now, that in itself did not cause the phone hacking scandal, did not cause the behaviour that appalled so many millions of people. That is the result of another, I would say, systemic, structural set of circumstances where journalists are forced to work harder across more platforms to try and beat their competition. And that arises from the kind of media market that we're seeing of enormous competition and enormous pressure. And I think the problem is where you have that kind of pressure, that kind of competition, together with the huge and very unaccountable institutions, groups like News Corporation, it can be catastrophic both for journalism and for democracy. And so what we need now out of the phone hacking saga is a serious debate about what kind of ownership structures would be best. How can we best use this opportunity, not just try and make sure that those kind of unethical journalistic practices go away, but to look for systems of regulation, structures of ownership that will present a much more open, inclusive, representative media system. So it's a very complicated situation where you have journalistic debates, you have all sorts of unhealthy political relationships accrued from this concentrated power epitomized by News Corporation. And we have to see this as a real opportunity to start to deal with questions of ownership concentration. So I think you have to be an optimist in this set of circumstances to think this is the one chance we're going to have for some years to tackle one of the most serious problems that we all face in Britain today.
Okay. Thanks very much. I think the question which kind of I have about this is that is this, you know, over-concentration of power or control, is it a byproduct of the new media environment? Is competition, as he says, harming, if you like, public interest, harming public interest journalism, or you know, what we've seen, the phone hacking scandal, is really something which is outside the environment itself? I mean, that's the key question. In other words, can we lump it all together? I wonder whether anybody would like to comment on that.
The phone hacking saga in England is just quite simply represents an event you don't want to have happen. you don't want to get to that point. And for me, it just reinforces the need for media ownership concentration and concentration rules and regulations to be maintained. And to rewind to history of the 2003, there was a rare moment of bipartisanship, really, when the FCC voted to massively deregulate media ownership, and found itself facing furore from the left and the right, and a vote in Congress which basically rolled back some of the media ownership relaxation limits in 2003. And that was really quite a tremendous sort of moment of for the media reform movement. And you'd like to think it would still happen today, that the outcome of a lot of that media deregulation is actually still in the courts and is going to come back and bite us fairly soon. I've got to say that thank God it happened over there, because maybe it'll stop us from having it happen over here, and we'll maintain these limits. So that's my really sort of impassioned hope.
You asked whether we think that has something to do with digital media. I think it doesn't. However, we shouldn't think that the online world is kind of free from issues like the ones being discussed here. And I wonder also whether we have the tools, not just legal, but even intellectual at this moment, to understand the dangers of concentration in the online realm. And I'm saying this because we're witnessing an increasing relevance of a few online platforms that control search and social networks and video online. And all these platforms, they have at least two things that make them tend towards monopolies. And one of them is that they all seem to learn from their own activity. They're constantly learning. Like a search engine gets better the more it's being used. So the more it's being used, the better it is, so the more people want to use it. And also you have the network effect, which is the more people who are in my network, the more interested the network is, so the more people join the network. So that creates these kind of like niche platforms for different online activities, which in the end seem to be unaccountable in certain levels about their behavior, because they don't have competitors, basically. So to go back to the question, no, this has, I think, nothing to do with digital media. However, we shouldn't lose sight of possible similar issues taking place in the online realm.
Thanks. Do you want to add it?
Well, I can see why concentration has led to, or some might think that concentration had led to this accident. But my question would be, was it an accident waiting to happen, a catastrophe waiting to happen, or is it just by chance or by conjunction of different things that led to it? Because if you believe in the first story, then it's systemic, and then you must do something about it. I'm not totally convinced that it's systemic. What is extremely troubling for someone like me, coming from where I come from, is the behavior of the police, the behavior of the politicians. That was something extremely shocking. That all these politicians were cuddling Murdoch. All these police people were completely in cahoot with this rogue journalist to expose simple citizens' lives, and that's something extremely troubling. And again, where does it come from? Is it systemic? Is it something inbuilt in the system that led to this, and then we need to legislate, to regulate? I don't know.
The increasing power, a very naive question. Of media, so.
I think there's some interesting design challenges. The internet was designed around open standards. The Facebook is not. You get an API, basically access into data on terms that Facebook provides you to their very valuable set of data. We can make choices, both as individuals, as system designers, or as legal policymakers, around the future, the online digital future that we have. And I think I'll echo Fernanda's point. We haven't yet got the people with the right set of skills to really understand the challenges in the way they need to be understood, and to work our way out of that. It's a work in progress, and I hope that there are some people in this room who want to be part of that.
Okay, let's go back to some questions. Yes, at the back there. Sorry, we've made things long.
Good evening. My name is Stéphanie Durand. I work at the Alliance of Civilizations, the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations. Can you hear me? Sorry. So I repeat. My name is Stéphanie Durand. I work in the media program of the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations. For those who don't know what it is, it's a special project of the Secretary General launched in 2007 to address intercultural tensions between the West and the so-called Muslim world. We actually just launched, talking about experience and activities in some of the regions of interest tonight, we just launched an online training yesterday together with the New York Times, including involving American, French, but also Tunisian and Egyptian journalists on the topic covering elections, because we think it's a crucial topic, not only because it's a time for election for Tunisia and Egypt in the coming weeks, but also because obviously there's the issue of how to cover elections in regimes that were not used to cover election democratically. So my question is to Aboukar, and I'm pleased to meet you in person after talking to you over the phone. How do you see the challenges in particular in Morocco, where you're from, but also in Tunisia for websites like yours, Lacom, but also Nawat in Tunisia? How do you see the issue of ethics for social media, for bloggers, of course, for important moments like elections, but more generally with this new generation of online presence? How will ethics be handled? How will training also in general be handled for people who don't necessarily have a traditional training in journalism?
Thanks very much. Let's have a few more questions there at the back, the gentleman.
Hello, I'm Guy Berger from South Africa, and I did the South African study for this OSI. And I came across two things that might be of interest to people here. The one is, it was extremely difficult to get an understanding of internet access in South Africa. For example, the ITU data gave a certain statistic which was based on them surveying people, did you use the internet once in the past year? Which is just a crazy question. And it also then, what is the internet? And what I found is that lots of people use the internet on their cell phones, they don't know they use the internet. So it turns out that most people using fixed line internet use it at their workplace, which has got implications for how they use it and what they can use it for. Those people who have internet access on their cell phones on 3G don't have necessarily broadband on that 3G. Second of all, the size of the screen limits what they can do, and the bandwidth and the cost limits whether they can do video or heavy density stuff on their phone. So I think these are quite important developments, because one throws around internet access as if it was a glib thing that's fairly easy to kind of measure. But actually, it's really complex in terms of what it really means. What I found in South Africa is that actually the killer application with cell phones is not internet access. It's still SMS, which is a one-to-one medium. And I suspect even in Tahrir Square, probably SMS played a greater role than social media. But you know, that I'd be interested to hear. The other thing that I looked at was digital television. And the transition from analog to digital television raises the huge question, well, if you've got this digital bandwidth for TV, what's going to go on it? And even in a relatively rich country like South Africa, there is not the business model to put indigenous content or local content in that digital space. So either there's going to be a load of rubbish imported from elsewhere, such as televangelism that comes from this country trying to squeeze local citizens for donations, or there's another alternative, and this, I think, becomes very important, whether that bandwidth can also be used for download of internet content that's high bandwidth. So in other words, whether you can have a hybrid system, and the hybrid system then points to the set-top box being the being the critical key potential for convergence, whereby people can uplink through a cell phone modem linked to their set-top box and download coming through the broadcast stream. So that's one of the debates that's taking place in policy circles in South Africa at the moment, except that the broadcasters don't like that, because they're still stuck in the model of broadcasting, we deliver to you. And of course, once you give people the technology through a set-top box whereby they can begin to actually choose what they want, and where you as a broadcaster have to become an ISP, it changes your paradigm. So those are some of the obstacles to digitization of media in South Africa.
Thanks very much. Thank you for that. Question here.
I'm Haley Cohen, and I worked as a fact checker at the New America Foundation this summer, and I'm going on a year-long fellowship to Yale to study the new media law in Argentina, but I haven't gone yet, so don't ask me any questions about that yet. But to speak to Tom's point about, you talked about the salary cuts in journalism, and obviously that translates to actual positions being cut, reporters being cut from beats, and I was wondering if any of you had any insights on how to fill those reporting gaps, and if those reporting gaps are to be filled with less expensive operators, so citizen journalism or things along those lines, how do we keep less expensive kind of systems accountable to the facts? And I think as a former fact checker, I'm especially interested in that, just in terms of if you don't have the money to employ editors and fact checkers, how do you make sure that what's being reported is accurate?
Okay, thanks very much. And one last, for this round, I meant, not last, as in last.
I'm Gwyneth Henderson. I've been in journalism and media for a very long time. I just want to go back, if I may, to the UK thing for a minute. Social media had nothing at all to do with the phone hacking thing. The phone hacking started long before, it goes back to the 90s, actually. But I think there's something else very important about it. We forget this. Why did the phone hacking come out in the end? It's not systemic. It came out because of journalism. It came out because of incredibly good journalism over a number of years under enormous pressure, supported by the private eyes and everything else. And of course, I'm talking about The Guardian. And I wonder if, you know, we're talking a lot about technical things. We're talking a lot about, you know, whether we maybe talk a little bit, ask you to address the questions of content and the impact on the content, and therefore the agendas and the subjects of discourse that are actually happening within nation or globally, because that's the thing that truthfully most concerns me. I don't much care what the platform is, but actually what are people actually getting and being able to assess, being able to examine, being able to use, because Mumsnet's first actually really important thing was during the election, had nothing to do with phone hacking.
Okay. Thanks very much. I mean, your question, I guess, is very much related to your question as well. You know, how do you cover the reporting gaps, or, you know, cutting off the salaries, etc., or a bigger question, is the digital media helping journalism, helping reporting, helping understanding? I think that's one question. And then second question, which is sort of related, how what are the ethical challenges, particularly in the Arab world? Let's concentrate on the first question first. Who do you want? Do you want to, Fernando?
No, actually, I was thinking that Abu Bakr probably has a...
Yeah, do you want to talk about the ethical question first? Sure. Fine, fair enough.
Yes, you mentioned Nawet. Nawet is a news website, a Tunisian news website, doing a fantastic work. And you mentioned Lekum, which is trying to do the same. And in fact, this is an answer to this ethical question, because if you think about the strategy of these two news websites, they're trying to build a brand. And if you want to try to build a brand, well, you should be ethically sound. And in fact, it answers one of the big problems with this new internet era, is that information is scattered all over the place. That's one. And secondly, there is a dearth of ways to make sense of this information, to render it intelligible, to connect the dots. So when we castigate editorialism and news analysis, actually we do need editorialism and news analysis to make sense of this vast amount of information we are bombarded with. So what's going on, and it's very hard because no one has come up. We were talking about, I was talking to Maris before about the US report, the MDM US report, and my question was simple. Did they find a business model? Because everyone is looking for this miraculous business model. So I was asking, in the US, did they find some business model that we can emulate elsewhere? And the answer was no, not yet. What Lekum and Nawet is trying to do, as other news websites before them all over the world, is to build brands. There is a reason you read the New York Times. You know, there is an economical rationale behind it, because you cannot read everything of interest to you. That's too much. So you need to go to one brand that will, you know, package all the interesting subjects for you and give them, deliver them to you in a way you pretty much like. Not 100%, but you pretty much like. That's what we're trying to replicate, but over the internet, and everybody else is trying to do the same, by the way. So it's a good evolution, is to have this new institutions that are beholden to their reputation, so that are that will be investing in ethical journalism, in trying to produce some sound analysis, sound information. To put some money, we have talked about how the most expensive genre in journalism is investigation.
So did you want to comment specifically on that?
Sorry.
Yeah. Sure. Daud Kutab again. I want to add to what Gwenna said about good journalism, because I think it's really important that we don't lose that. And I'll give an example in Jordan. I think we've seen like a circle. We were witnessing at one time almost no access to good journalism or good information, let's say. And then now there's everybody can write, everybody can create their own website, but the quality of journalism hasn't increased. I mean, the same good articles are being republished in all the new websites, and there's a lot of rubbish that's also being published on the new website. So I think we've come around the fact that there was not enough platforms. Now there's too many platforms, but the quality of journalism has not improved in a good way. I mean, important stories, breakthrough stories, people can break now stories. And so information is now available, but hard-hitting, investigative reporting that takes a lot of really good journalism and you know, just quality of time to be done hasn't really changed. So I think we need to give both these issues. And in fact, the bad stuffing on journalism is giving internet a very bad name, and now countries are putting a lot of laws and raising up very much high fees for things like, you know, character assassination. Now they just passed a law in Jordan, 30,000 JDs, which is like about $50,000 if you character assassination. So you say somebody is a corrupt person or an official and you can't prove it, you go to jail, or you pay $50,000. It's a lot of money, and it's basically to kind of create these legal systems to stop people from saying things without proof. And if you don't have access to information, how can you get good proof? So it's a vicious cycle.
Okay. Did you finish your point, Abubakar?
In fact, thanks, Daud, for this intervention, because I happen to have a different opinion on this. I think that if the quality of journalism has not improved, it's not because you have this wild space that is internet, because it's a problem of a business model. It's not a problem of. On the contrary, I do believe that this lowering of barriers to entry to everyone to write and to make his information public is actually very hard on professional journalists, because it keeps them on their toes. Because if their work is not good enough, it's known in the second, and everybody will know it. So, and I would guess that on the contrary, it helps produce better journalism. But the big question is really the business model.
Okay, Fernando and Tom, is it helping better journalism, and how are we filling the reporting gaps or fact-checking gaps?
It's
a big question,
question, and it's a very ripe one, especially in the US with the massive layoffs that have happened. And Haley, I understand your concerns. We need good journalism. It's not, as the lady said, about, you know, if you haven't got the journalism, doesn't matter what platform it's on. We've struggled with this, and we've, you know, pushed it. The report is looking at what's going on. And really, you've got to sit back and say, so we're spending more on media and communications per capita than we have before. But less money is actually going to produce news, and that's it's because the market is the bundling of the in commonly sort of still as the box scores in the baseball that are easy to collect with the hard hitting news that you had to buy because you had to buy it as a newspaper is not happening. You get niche news. People go to the website with the box scores a lot more, and that generates the advertising revenue. The economics of newspapers are just getting worse. So you, there's no, I personally am not convinced there's a magic bullet anywhere for this. The question is, where did it come from? And people have struggled to see this, see what it could be. And the obvious ones is philanthropy or greater non-profit funded journalism. And I think that's definitely an element. But I think we have to look really seriously in the US, especially, at the publicly funded media. We, as US taxpayers, pay $1.35 per capita per year on public media. Our nearest OECD competitor, Canada, spends 20, the UK spends 60. Is it any wonder that there's a difference between the journalism the BBC produces? The scope of what PBS and public radio can produce. And the other side of this is that some of this, I think at the local level, will come out of some citizen reporting, but this is not going to magically appear. Citizen reporters are not wonderful journalists just because they are citizens who see a car crash. We've got to think about the local anchor institutions that we need to design in the community, around libraries, around community centers, that will get funded in some way to connect people with news. And I think we've just got to recognize that the business model, we're not going to innovate our way out of this. We are going to get lower cost as the cost of newsprint just disappears as people stop using printing presses. But the good journalism still just costs money.
To try to answer that question and also link it with part of what the gentleman from South Africa mentioned before, when he says, we have all these outlets, all these channels, but how are we going to fill them? I think we tend to forget the economics of attention. It's like, we have that much attention span and that many people who can pay attention to the media, so the fact that we increase and multiply the offer doesn't mean that people are actually going to be watching more, because there's a clear limit to that. And that limit to attention also affect the amount of capital that you can put into the media. It's like we cannot have the same amount of money to develop one channel as we have to develop 10 channels. We kind of multiply the investment in 10 times. And so that takes me to the question about quality journalism. I think we cannot think about quality journalism in isolation. It's newspapers, reporters producing this wonderful investigative journalism. Unless we are able to understand the whole dynamic of the media production and consumption, we won't be able to understand whether we actually improving the quality of journalism or we're actually degrading it. And part of the problem is that a significant amount of revenue is moving away from traditional journalistic sources into other types of media, many of which are online platforms. So we cannot just ignore the context if we want to explain what happens with journalism these days.
I've got one more response to Guy Berger's comments. I mean, and Guy, I suspect you may know all this because I know you're very knowledgeable in all these issues. But I mean, there are some fascinating experiments in Australia with the way the Australian National Broadband Plan, National Broadband Network is being developed, and in New Zealand, basically a very different model that's of massive investments around how to create connectivity in both in urban and in rural areas. And you contrast those models with what's going on in the US, which is actually a remarkably modest attempt at relatively low cost, with relatively modest goals of connectivity, both urban and, to be quite frank, rural connectivity assumptions are premised on 4G is good enough. And as you said yourself, 4G isn't cable broadband. And I think it's, we may have to re-examine that in this country with the norms that we set, but there's plenty of options out there for how it can be done, as I, you know.
Yep. Question there.
One more question to Tom. Back to the issue of quality journalism. The stunning difference you mentioned between expenditure for public media in US, Britain, and Canada, is it making or could it make a difference online?
So the way public media or public federal spending on public media is actually 99% allocated, or approximately that, to both radio and television. 75% of that money goes to public television. I personally would be very supportive of broadening the vehicles to receive that money, and I think it could make a massive difference online. There was a great article in the New York Times last week, or maybe it's earlier this week, around topics, a sort of a chat room space that become popular in many small towns as the only place where things get discussed, and it's of local gossip, and it's not particularly invigorating or a positive picture of the future. If you just think of what a public television entity could be in this century, as opposed to when public media and public broadcasting was founded in the last century, is just a tremendously exciting opportunity for two-way engagement of citizens, engaging citizen journalists, but also supporting and fact-checking what's found, and really contributing to the democratic process in a way that was always envisaged through in a sort of educational way with old-school public broadcasting, but could be really remade. And it's just an opportunity that I am, I'm excited about, yet, as I said with Congress, you can't get too optimistic right now with how things are going. It's entirely possible that public funding could be completely zeroed out in the Super Congress debates that are going on right now. And although I think that may not happen, I would like to see much more innovation and money going into online entities.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Peter Kanoy from Skylight Pictures, which is a independent documentary producing company. Oh, and this is a question for all or any of the panelists. We're beginning an experiment in trying to help collect and develop the historic memory in Guatemala for a period of time that took place during extreme violence in Guatemala that nobody there really wants to talk about. And we're using the internet in a kind of sort of a wiki model to try to get many, many individuals to add their memories to some kind of understanding of what happened during that time period. And I'm wondering if any of you in your research have come across this type of use of internet.
Okay. Anybody wants to?
I'm trying to think, and I don't recall any specific case. Though, yeah, Colombia maybe has some case of websites in which people can tell their experiences of violence and the problems of violence that the country has gone through in recent years. I think that would be the closest thing to what you mentioned. But let me ask you, is this you're recording people's memories on camera, or is it just like opening a space for people to come and join and express themselves and tell their stories, or?
We're using a trigger of a documentary film that we're about to release in Guatemala, mm-hmm. which in test screenings really gets people to speak a lot about their experiences, mm-hmm. And so some of it is going to be, you know, hand collected from younger generation collecting the stories from the older generation, mm-hmm. with a cell phone application, and some of it you know, will be like a StoryCorps booth in certain places where people come to add their memories, and then have these curated onto a site that's a public site that can be accessed mm-hmm. by the general public.
I wonder, Gordana, do you sort of know any of the, because with your overview of the various media?
I actually don't know much of similar experiences, but I think it would be very interesting to debate the possible use of media in similar experiments around the country that were offline that could be now put online, and I would be willing to talk to you after that.
There was a point here, I think.
There are a lot of... Hi, Jessica Clark, Center for Social Media and Local Lore and New America, and various other things. There are a lot of different variations on this theme, like the It Gets Better campaign. People are collecting stories of being bullied because they're gay and lesbian as youth and how it got better. The Holocaust Museum in Philly has a story booth where they have prompt people to talk about values related to tolerance. So it's definitely a model that's been tried in a lot of different venues. There was a lot of there were several experiments around this anniversary of 9/11. You can look at futurepublicmedia.net if you want to find some.
Miguel, you had the point there.
Yeah, well, something that you could look at is Holman Morris, a Colombian journalist. He had a documentary called Impunity, right. And he has 700 hours of recordings of victims of violence on camera, which he is planning to put online on a virtual museum of memory. So Impunity. It was shown in New York in the Human Rights Festival.
One of the granddaddies of these kinds of sites are Susan Micellis's website, aka Kurdistan, which is interactive with the Kurdish diaspora.
Good. Okay, I think we're coming to the end of our time. It's been a fascinating discussion. I was very tempted to try and reduce the discussion to a simple single question. Anyway, I'll have a go at it. Because of the discussion that we had towards the end of the debate about whether or not digital media has helped, if you like, journalism or not. Is there a notion that new media is a dangerous thing, or is it a good thing? Or, I mean, how many people here think that it has really helped journalism and it has helped democracy? Hands up those who think that it has. Very good. Hands up those who think it hasn't. I think the positives win overwhelmingly. I think on that positive note, we better conclude. Thank you all very much indeed. And you could watch the whole thing again, I think, in a few days or a few weeks, in a couple of days, I think. And if you want, here are the www.soros.org or www.mediapolicy.org or fora.tv. These are the three sites. If you want them to make a note of them, Miguel can help you afterwards. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you.